Recovery Elevator, episode 477.
The thing is, alcohol is so compelling to someone who's gotten bit by the bug that it will make them keep drinking, even though they see loud and clear where it's going, and it will even make an honest person lie.
Welcome to the Recovery Elevator Podcast. My name is Paul Churchill, and I'm so excited to be here with you today. On today's episode, we have Jim. He's 44 years old, from Silicon Valley, California, and took his last drink on February 20th, 2024. Great job, Jim. I want to say what's up to all of our Cafe Ari chat hosts. Thank you so much. You guys do an incredible job. Listeners, today is going to be a good day. I can feel it. Now, I'm a fan of books, so I'm happy to share this. Barnes & Noble opened 31 new bookstores in 2023, which was more than it opened in the past 10 years combined. And in 2024, they are hoping to open between 50 and 60 new stores. Now, I remember on January 1st, 2010, I walked into a Barnes & Noble in Seattle, Washington, and I pulled the book off the Quit Lit shelf, Beyond the Influence by Catherine Ketchum, and I began my alcohol-free journey. And now a word from our sponsor, BetterHelp.
I recently had the opportunity to go to a chat by Liz Gilbert, who is the author of Eat, Pray, Love, and she talked a lot about boundaries and priorities. What would you do if you had extra time in your day? Where are your priorities and how are you protecting them? Therapy can help you find what matters to you so you can do more of it. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/elevator today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/elevator.
Okay, let's get started. This September, I'm coming up on 10 years without a drink, which I'm so happy about. Over the past decade, I found myself in a myriad of different social occasions where I consumed zero beverages containing alcohol. When I told people I wasn't drinking, or people became aware that I wasn't drinking, a question that I got was this, and it's really less of a question and more of how it is asked. So the question was, wait, you're not drinking. And with the intonation, it sounds like this. Wait, you're not drinking? It's almost as if the question is more of a statement or a rhetorical question. I've been asked this question at bars, bachelor parties, weddings, at my own wedding, football games, kids' birthday parties, concerts, and more. Again, the way people ask the question indicates it's more of a statement of astonishment than anything, like it's at the earth-shattering level, as in the impossible was happening before their eyes. I remember once at a New Year's party, someone who was a bit tipsy was like, so wait a second, you're telling me you walked in the door of this house, walked up to that cooler and pulled out a soda water and you're still here? Are you having fun? Now, none of the question was passive aggressive nor meant to insult me. This person was in awe that this can be done, and it can. Now, a major factor of why ditching the booze can be so hard is the thinking mind will tell you it can't be done. It's not possible, and it's on the same plane as teleporting or becoming invisible. The biggest reason for this is an alcohol-free life lies in the unknown. A life without alcohol represents a major step in the unknown, which the mind does not like because it has trouble keeping you safe in the unknown. The mind, the ego, craves the known. Even though the known may contain heart palpitations at 3 a.m., uncontrollable anxiety, and crippling depression. But, listeners, this can be done. To the tune of 38% of Americans don't drink alcohol at all, and this is up from 29% in the 70s. So more and more Americans and human beings in general are saying, nope, not for me. Again, this can be done. This can be done by you. If you are on day one, a series of day ones, I want to remind you that yes, this can be done. But you may be asking the question, but for how long can this be done? A morning, an afternoon, a whole day, a week, a month, a year? Well, you probably saw this one coming. We are only ditching the booze one day at a time. In fact, that's all we can do is one day at a time. But, and stick with me, the duration you quit drinking for is a fun one because this is what tends to happen. Once you get over the initial detox and the mind fog starts to clear, your physical health starts to rebound quickly and something inside of you will say, whoa, let's keep this hangover-free train going. Earlier in this intro, I mentioned on January 1st, 2010, I started my alcohol-free journey. Now, I had to start again, well, several times, and it stuck in 2014. But my initial plan in 2010 was to quit drinking for the month of January. But I remember my body providing so many signs of physical healing that I said to myself, it would be silly to not let the healing continue. The big one, I remember, was energy and vitality. I was constantly tired and always seeking a nap when alcohol was in my life. In less than 10 days, I would say my energy levels doubled. Now, the point I want to hammer down again in this intro is absolutely 100% this can be done. This referring to an alcohol-free life. You can attend any function without the booze. In fact, once you do this a couple of times, you'll begin to see your past self and others who perhaps got the party started beforehand. You'll perhaps hear people slurring their speech. You'll see people with an imaginary tether to them and the bar, which doesn't allow them to go more than 10 feet away from the source of alcohol at all times. You'll see the 1.0 version of yourself, the one who becomes less capable of maneuvering life after each drink consumed. Then you see the 2.0 version of yourself, and in moments of clarity, the thought of going back to alcohol will be such an atrocious violation to the self that it becomes almost unthinkable. AKA, the obsession has been lifted. Listeners, I absolutely had that same voice, the voice that says, no way I can do X, Y, and Z without drinking. That voice was loud, oppressive, and incorrect. Now, here is the beauty of what an addiction does for us, not to us. An addiction forces us to confront the thinking mind. The addiction forces us to tease out who is who in the thinking mind. It forces us to locate and meet our authentic self. Hello, Paul. So yes, this can be done. This can be done on good days. This can be done on bad days. This can be done when a family member graduates high school, college, or gets married. This can be done when a family member passes away. This can be done when a pet leaves us. This can be done in paradise. This can be done in hell. And if you do find yourself in hell at the moment, keep moving forward. Listeners, I hope you enjoyed this intro. I'm so appreciative of this audience and thank you for listening. And before we hear from Jim, let's hear from SoberLink. Picture this. You're sober, but nobody believes you. When trust is gone, there's one surefire way to get it back, SoberLink. SoberLink is in a league of its own when it comes to remote alcohol monitoring. Here's why it's a game changer. Scheduled daily tests become part of your new routine, showing consistency in your efforts. Built-in facial recognition ensures each test is unmistakably yours. Tamper sensors safeguard any attempt to cheat the system. Now the real magic, advanced reporting. This feature shares your progress instantly, with detailed, easy-to-read reports sent directly to your loved ones. It's not just about proving you're sober, it's about sharing your success, establishing patterns of trust, and dispelling doubts with hard evidence. You guys know, here at RE, we only back what we believe in, and this system is the real deal. Visit www.soberlink.com/recovery-elevator to sign up and receive $50 off device. Again, that's www.soberlink.com/recovery-elevator and sign up to receive $50 off device. Jim, how are you?
I'm doing wonderful.
All right. Fantastic to hear, Jim. I am pumped to be here with you. I'm pumped to hear your story personally and to share it with the Recovery Elevator audience. Let's get right into this, Jim. When was your last drink?
Yeah, so my last drink was on February 20th, which as of right now is 3 days ago.
Yeah, brother. 3 days away from your last drink. At the time of the recording, you know, we're about 6-8 weeks always ahead of production schedule. So this, I think it's a drop in early April. But right now, my man, Jim, you're 3 days alcohol free, 3 days away from your last drink. I just got to ask you, man, how are you feeling right now?
I'm actually feeling wonderful. I'm feeling wide awake, alert, even though it's early in the morning. Even though the sleep isn't where it should be yet, I know that's going to improve. And I'm just feeling really hopeful.
Yeah, you know why it's fresh? I gotta ask. I was gonna ask about the sleep. You know, how has it been the last 2 nights? Did you have sweats? You know, has the anxiety been peaked? You know, the first 72 hours is the most intense of the withdrawal symptoms. So how's it been for you?
Yeah, well, let's see. I think I'm gonna have to change the sheets. Like honestly, I've been waking up every couple hours just like sticky and so yeah, I've definitely got the sweat experience, but anxiety is okay. In previous times when I've been sober for a while, in the early days, I've definitely felt myself being a jerk to absolutely everybody around me. But since my last relapse wasn't very long, just a couple of weeks, I feel like that level of addiction didn't really get to take hold very deeply. So I'm feeling okay.
There we go. Harm reduction is a real thing. Now, Jim, before we get into your story, I want to pick up right where we left off, but let's learn a little bit more about you. Jim, give listeners some background about yourself, where you're from, maybe what you do for a living. Do you have a family? And most importantly, Jim, what do you like to do for fun?
So I live in Silicon Valley. I am a software engineering manager at one of those big tech firms. So I'm a nerd and I always have been. I'm 44, happily married, very, very happily married to a wonderful wife for 21 years now. My marriage is old enough to drink. And we've got three young kids and they're a lot of work, but you know. Yeah, for fun, I like to ski in the wintertime, not in the summertime. I've been trying to get into woodworking, but that's a little bit of an uphill battle. But what really energizes me is going through my task list. I'm not even kidding. I procrastinate on it so much, but when I get to polish those things off, it's so energizing. It's like, yeah! So that's actually fun for me, just doing stuff around the house.
Yeah, whatever works, man. And I hear you on the woodworking. I just pulled a miter saw out of a box like 45 minutes ago. I love that myself and want to get more into that. So, Jim, let's do what we came here to do. I want to hear your story about alcohol, into alcohol addiction, into a drinking problem, however you want to phrase that. And then I cannot wait to hear about these 3 days. And, you know, I recently did an early sobriety roll call for interviewees on the podcast. And there's a line in the rooms that says the newcomer is the most important person. Fully track with that. There's a thing called the ism, the alcohol ism, the incredible short memory. Sometimes when we get people on the podcast who aren't that far away from the last drink, it's like a refresher for all of us who are listening. Plus, you're more relatable, Jim. You're more relatable to the person, you know, who's still on day one over and over. I remember when I was on this journey, when I heard somebody who had 5 years, 10 years, I'm like, that's great. That's awesome. Look, but like, how am I going to get day one, two, three? Well, Jim, tell them how you did it and you're going to give some advice. So, Jim, let's do this. I'm going to let you start wherever you want to go. I'm going to ask some questions as I normally do. Let's do it, my man.
All right, sure. Yeah, so, you know, alcohol was, you know, kind of a non-issue for much of my life. First drink was when I was about 14 or 15. My brother gave me a beer. It didn't really impress me. He invited me up when I was 15. He invited me up to a fraternity party when he was attending college as a freshman. And I got very drunk. And I enjoyed that, but that was just a one-off and nothing else ever happened following that. In high school, you know, being a nerd, I didn't have friends, and so I didn't have people inviting me to parties. So didn't drink with that. In college, I didn't drink, joined a dry fraternity, not because I was trying to avoid alcohol, but just because it was just irrelevant to my life. And you know, I picked a fraternity because of who they were. Even getting out of college, went through my 20s. Maybe occasionally I'd have a bottle of wine with dinner with my wife, but you know, non-issue. When I was 30, I joined my current employer, this big tech firm, and you know, one of the things they did was you know, every Friday would you know call in the entire company like, hey, let's have some beers. So like these giant gatherings with lots of beer where no one's tracking how much you're drinking. And I thought, ooh, free beer. Yeah. And so that was where I got to rather enjoy alcohol. And that progressed. That definitely progressed over time.
Jim, I got a question with that. You're 44 years old. I don't think you mentioned that in the intro, but you told me
Oh,
that
sorry.
before we hit
Yes.
recording. Just so listeners know the age, 14
Yep.
years ago, that's kind of when the happy hour started at the big tech firm. You
That's
know,
right.
just take a second and comment on that culture, the corporate culture Friday. I imagine everybody comes in the workspace to gather with alcohol. Is it a big part of the workspace there?
You know, in all the places I've seen, it's not like there's a group of people who are sort of always on call 24/7, and they have a strong culture of like, oh, okay, we're going to have, you know, liquor at our desks and that kind of thing. It was kind of like Mad Men, but that was never part of my life.
Gotcha.
You know, it was always just like, hey, this is a social gathering. We're going to use a social lubricant, and we're going to give presentations about all of the cool things that we made in the last week. So it was definitely not a boozy culture.
Gotcha. And then you mentioned it progressed. Go for it.
So I mean, just I would take that home, and you know, at a certain point, I decided, oh, restaurants serve alcohol. I think I will have something instead of a Diet Coke. And so I sort of overindulged on that. But it wasn't that bad for a while until it did become bad. And that's when the mental health struggles started to set in. That's when depression got bad. That's when anxiety got bad. My boss started to talk to me about, like, hey, you're becoming kind of impossible to work with. And that was a little bit rough. And I started to feel like, with the drinking increasing, which didn't seem like a problem, even though it was definitely having consequences, you know, just like I think everybody else who's ever listened to this podcast, you know, would like, oh no, I'm fine. And that was the thing. I thought I was fine, but I also knew at the same time that I was not living the life that I should. I felt like I was kind of living a triple life. So like, here I am, I'm a family man, I'm a man of faith, really active in my church. At this time I was actually a deacon in my church, which at that particular church was a role of just sort of helping people out when they were going through struggles. My focus was personal finance issues and when people are going through struggles there. So you know, so that was one thing, just being a generally good guy. Next one is I come to work and I'm, you know, purely rational. Don't bring that faith stuff to work. Just keep that right in the closet where it belongs. And so you know, I double life there. And then now, okay, I'm also the town drunk. And you know, so that sort of threatens both of those things. And so, you know, what should anyone do when they're faced with that kind of circumstance? Quit drinking? No, I stepped down as a deacon because I couldn't live with hypocrisy.
Jim, let's back up just a hot second here. You know, you're 30 years old and you said it progressed. When did you first have like the mental health issues, depression? What age would you say?
I'm going to say it happened at age 37.
Okay, 37. You're perhaps, I think you said the boss is like, hey, you're challenged to work with, struggling with anxiety, depression. Was there a voice in, you know, about alcohol, like, hey, let's double down. This is an effective medicine for a while. It is for a lot of people. Or was there a voice going internal saying, like, this has got to go, or maybe we explore this?
You know, the funny thing is, for whatever reason, I've never felt like alcohol was something used to cope, and that's something that sort of set me apart from, or made it difficult for me to relate to a lot of the people that I've spoken with who did find it a coping thing. But for me, it was always just, I like this, I enjoy doing this. And then when the hiding started to happen, it's like, oh, right now is a chance for me to get away with it. And so opportunity has always been my biggest trigger. It's never been coping.
Gotcha, gotcha. And I think one of the dangerous parts about an addiction or alcohol or the addiction process is that the blinders, we can't quite peg. For me, I couldn't peg the mental health issues, the depression, anxiety, to the alcohol, right? It was something like at the conscious level. I can't touch the alcohol. That can't be it. I love what you said about the deacon part, and this kind of summarizes just, you know, the blinders. It's like this is really hard to see where we put things in priority with a deacon, like, where instead of exploring alcohol, I think you used the word the town drunk. Maybe you might be a little hard on yourself there. I don't know all the story yet. We're gonna hear it.
Maybe, maybe.
You know, like, hey, I can either quit alcohol or I can step down as a deacon. I'm curious about that. Like, was there a voice to be like, dude, we are stepping down from a deacon, so we're choosing alcohol over that? Was that awareness there?
No, because I also told myself, like, oh, well, you know, there are various other factors, and I blamed it all on that. But really, and this is the first time I'm actually admitting this to anyone. The driving force in the back of my mind was just an understanding that I believed I was not fit for service. And by the way, I'm not for a second saying that that applies to any other person. I was just saying that I felt the strong sense that, like, look, I am objectively getting drunk. And sure, that is incompatible for me. But I knew I didn't have a problem. So it wasn't like I was just going to stop drinking. I know these thoughts don't make sense when you put them together, but they were all 100% true in my mind. And I never really took the time to really examine that.
Gotcha. Jim, you're doing great, my man. Keep going.
Okay. Yeah. So that's where I stood. And then COVID hit, and that was really difficult for me, as it has been for a lot of people. And so suddenly I found myself stuck at home. And due to just, I won't get into the long details, but basically my team at work collapsed during our COVID hiring freeze because everyone was trying to figure out, what do we do now? So here I am, a manager with no team. There's nothing for me to do. Normally I'd be hiring, but I can't hire because there's a hiring freeze. So what do? Oh, well, gee, it's you know, mid-afternoon. It's a good time for me to go shopping, air quotes around that. And so I every day it was like, oh, well, hey, honey, I'm going to run to the store. I'm going to get some things for dinner. And it wasn't just getting some things for dinner. It was also getting some recreational beverages to go with my shopping experience. And that became a habit. That became a frequent, maybe daily habit. And then something really bad happened. So the hiring freeze was lifted, and I'm trying to hire, and my kids decide that they want to be participants in every meeting because I'm sitting there at home. I'm trying to be in the office, and you know, if I lock the door, it's like bang, 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 bang. Like, so that made it really difficult, and I thought, I know, I have a good idea. Even though my workplace has its doors locked, I'm just going to rent an office so I can work in peace. Now I'm locked by myself all day in the face of my biggest trigger, which is opportunity, and a brewing habit of drinking every day in the early afternoon or mid afternoon.
Sure. And it's almost like, you know, the drinking has you right where it wants you to be, could be said.
It is, yeah. And like, if I had been plugged into a recovery community at the time, you know, they would be like, what the world are you doing? Think, dude. Right. But I didn't have anyone to say that to me. And so, you know, all I had is my kind of addicted brain saying, like, hey, here's a good idea. And I was left to my own devices. And that's when things got really bad. That's when I got to feel the crippling hangovers that would leave me in bed, like, for hours after I should have been up. All these symptoms. I started to land, you know, to get mystery illnesses that would put me in the ER, like just weird stuff that just started happening. Started to get some concerning lab work numbers back. Like, my health was taking a deep nosedive. And I may not remember this very much, but I'm 100% certain that I was not being there for my family the way I had to be. And so that was difficult. That was all very difficult. And so, you know, I did the web search that I think most of us have done, you know, am I an alcoholic? I wonder what percentage of our listeners have ever done that search.
My hand just went up.
Yeah, there we go. So at a certain point I realized, okay, I have to stop. And I did the usual, the things that we all try. Oh, I'll cut down. Oh, I'll moderate. All those.
Jim, question, when you said, okay, I have to stop. When, about how old were you? Like, what was the time frame? How long?
Yeah, I think that really didn't start until 41. So this is a good probably year and a half after the COVID lockdown started.
Gotcha.
I'm time enough for things to really spiral downward for a while.
Okay.
But yeah, so I finally, you know, one of the things that I do was I was going to Bible study meetings once a week, and I found myself five drinks in, approaching the house where they were held, and I was like, what do you do? What, this makes no sense. You need to pull up your local AA meeting. And that's not something that sober me would have ever contemplated because, of course, I don't have a problem. But I had no other way to explain the circumstances I found myself in. And so I went there, and that was my first meeting. I didn't really plan for it, but there I was. And that's when I started to explore the whole recovery thing. And that it took like a year before anything stuck. I tried several different AA meetings. I tried two different Celebrate Recovery meetings. I tried an independent 12-step meetings and I ultimately decided, like, the 12-step framework, while it's wonderful and has worked for a lot of people and it's great, 12-step in general doesn't work for me, and I needed to look to something else. And one of the things I needed to do, I knew I finally had to open up with my wife about it. I had been hiding about this for so long. I hadn't heard the framework of burning the ships yet, but that's exactly what it was. I knew I needed to do that. And I feared it so much.
You feared it, but you knew you had to do it. I want to hear that. But listeners, you said you woke up and said, this has got to stop. Like, there is a consciousness growing inside you that is gaining energy, momentum, saying, look, this has got to stop. You're going to a Bible meeting and saying, like, wait a second, I'm going to the wrong meeting. And sometimes in altered states of consciousness and with alcohol, like, we can also quit drinking while we're drunk. Hang with me for a second. We can look at it differently. And you can start building the idea of sobriety while using alcohol. As other people talk about this. You can look at it differently while you're intoxicated. Say, look, yeah, this is an issue, because you said, you know, the sober me would not have admitted that or whatnot. Go to an AA meeting. You're doing great, Jim. Keep going.
Yeah. So I really feared talking to my wife about this, because, you know, except for her occasionally, you know, finding empties around the house and me successfully explaining that away, at least I think I was successful. Maybe she just didn't want to face that possibility that her husband was struggling with this. But I knew that coming clean to her would be extraordinarily hurtful. And I knew it would be painful for our relationship. And I had no idea how bad it would be. You know, initially it was like, what do you mean? You're not that bad. It's fine. And then over the next few days, she started to think through her memories of all the times when I was dropping the ball, or I was falling asleep on the couch, or all the empties she found. And she realized the depth of the deception that I had been giving her. And yeah. She very, very rightfully felt very betrayed. Mm-hmm. And at one point, she says to me, you know, I think this is the end of closeness and intimacy in our marriage. And what she meant by intimacy, by the way, not sex, but she referred to like the closeness. And I stopped and I said to her, you know, honey, when drinking starts to get really bad, and when people drink themselves to death, eventually when things get that bad, they see it coming. They feel that pain in their liver area. You know, some of them get the neuropathy, you know, the pancreatitis, the lab numbers, the hangovers. They see it coming. And the thing is, alcohol is so compelling to someone who's gotten bit by the bug that it will make them keep drinking, even though they see, well, like, loud and clear where it's going. And it will even make an honest person lie. Mm. And that's what it did to me. I said that to her. And I think that she may have understood that it doesn't mean that I'm generally someone who doesn't care, someone who doesn't care about the truth, doesn't hold any regard for her. That it's that I've gotten stuck by this horrible thing that kills people with their eyes wide open. And I let her know about all of the things that I was going to do, because I'm not going to take this lying down. I'm not going to be, I will not tolerate going down that particular rabbit hole. I'm still 100% committed to her, to being a great dad, to God. And I'm not going to make the wrong choice on this one. And
Jim,
so
I got to ask a question, and I don't really like this question, because people peg their drinking to your answer, and it really doesn't matter. But like, how much were you drinking? Were you drinking daily? Was it all day? Was it just at the night, you know, before you burned the ships with your wife?
Yeah. I'm going to say it would typically start around 3 or 4 in the afternoon. And I'm going to say it would average 10 to 12 a night. Sometimes it'd be more like 15 or 20, in unusual circumstances. It was rarely less than about 8.
Gotcha. And Jim, there was a deeper you that knew, look, this is the most important relationship in my life. If I'm going to have any traction with this, I have to get her on the same page with my trajectory in life, that the alcohol has got to go. You're listening to a deeper voice. You're like, this is going to suck. She can take this in 101 ways. And of course, there was pain. There was hurt. Trust has been compromised. Trust has been fractured. Did it come back together within time? Did you come back together and get on the same page?
Yes. Our marriage is great. It is, okay. It is great today. There has been forgiveness, reconciliation, and not just a few weeks ago, before my latest relapse, she told me that she was proud of how good things were going.
Wow.
Yeah. And I expect that to be better. I fully intend for this to be the time when I stop for good. It might not be, but I do know that I will pick myself back up. And she knows that too.
Okay. So the ships are burned with your wife. And listeners, I think this is one of the most monumental steps in Jim and your alcohol-free journey, that moment right there. All right. So what happens after that?
So I finally just said, okay, 12 steps isn't going to work for me. What is going to work? And I started to put together my own recovery program, which, you know, a lot of people would say, how well do you expect that to work? But in my case, I feel like it's been the best thing for me. And so that consisted mostly of recovery elevator. And also I started journaling. I got myself one of these e-notebooks, and I've now filled it with like hundreds of pages. But yeah, so just every day, I would take stock of things. I would ask myself about a dozen questions, same dozen questions every day. And then just write free form for maybe a half an hour. And like that was really good for framing my thoughts and, you know, really examining the reason behind stuff. I picked up some of the things that I learned from Smart Recovery. That system also didn't really speak to me, but it had a lot of really, really good points. And I did some journaling about those. But so between that and a Sober Tracker app, the podcasts and a bunch of stuff, it finally started to work. And so for a while I got up to, I think, 57 days. Which I clearly remember how amazing every single day of that felt, maybe except for the first few days, but after that,
I got you.
How amazing that felt. And you know, I relapsed when I was off by myself for a while, and that led to, you know, several months, at which one point I said, okay, it's time for me to moderate. And I went through that lesson, but it was important for me because even though I had heard a million people say, you can't moderate, it doesn't work, I needed to know that for myself. And, I got right back down on the elevator down and, you know, got to experience all that pain again. But I learned that lesson. And as part of all of this, I ended up during one of my journaling times just reading over everything that I had written over the past, the entire time since I'd been journaling. And this is, by the way, this is last year. This is when I was 43. And so what I realized, I distilled this into a couple of different lessons: that drinking is, for me, always progressive. It is always intensely painful, that moderation cannot work, and a few things like this. And for each one of these, I footnoted it with a few dates on journal entries so that if I ever question that, if I ever say, well, it's not that bad, I can go read it in my own words and say, well, forget what everyone else has to say. Here's what I have to say. About everything that added up to that judgment. And so you add all that up and it's like, here's why, in case you ever forget, here's why you don't do it again. And that was huge for me.
Jim, there's a spiritual teacher named Krishnamurti. He passed away 20, 30, 40 years ago. And I think he's most famously known for, well, some of his teachings are, the pathway to truth and the wholeness is a pathless land, meaning that there are no sequence of steps, there are no order of pathways that you have to take to find wholeness. And so what you said earlier of like, well, you know, AA didn't work for me, that's totally fine. And it sounds like you gave it a shot. A pet peeve of mine is when people are like, AA doesn't work for me, but they've never even been to a meeting, and totally fine. And you piece together what is working. And the trajectory that I'm hearing you, from you, Jim, into sobriety, into an alcohol-free life, is very similar trajectory for so many people. First off, you have an addiction, which is a bundle of energy that's moving down a very steep precipice. That's the progression. And then something of equal or greater force, and this is sobriety, needs to be built. It's like a tender egg. It's an idea that needs to be nurtured. And we take these big steps forward, knowing there will be pain, such as burning the ships, knowing there's going to be nights when we're drenching the sheets with sweat. But eventually something starts to click. And I've done data on this. I don't want to dishearten listeners. And there are so many one and done stories. Hey, I'm done drinking, adios, peace. But for many people, once they hit that conscious realization of like, look, this has got to go, it can be a couple years. It can be definitely several months before it clicks. You know, and let's zoom in like this last little bit here. Did 3 days ago something happen? You did mention that before this last episode of drinking, and we call it field research here at Recovery, because every time we go out there, Recovery Elevator, every time we go out there, like we're going to, when we drink, we learn something more. And if we do it with loving awareness of how we're drinking, with like one on the outside, one on the inside, I love how you went back and read your hundreds of pages of footnotes and said, oh shit, alcohol is the source of pain. Nothing good's coming from this. You know, there's like 100 questions I just asked in there, but one. But like, talk about how this last episode wasn't quite the full dumpster fire. And then how do we get into these 3 days right now?
Yeah, for a while it was bad because, you know, I had the experience of, you know, even though it was only a couple of weeks that I had been off sobriety, I started to feel hopeless. I started to feel like, well, yesterday I had all the hope in the world and still drank. The day before, I felt even more intensely, this ain't going to happen today. Afternoon hits, I'm drinking. And I started to lose hope. Like, I'm sorry, this problem is bigger than I am. I can't do it. Nothing I can do can help. I started to feel that. And then I started to forget my why. I really started to think about my thoughts when I was making those afternoon decisions to drink. And I found myself asking, well, what's the big deal tonight? You know, why shouldn't I drink? And So one morning I spent some time in prayer and just approaching God and addressing all this stuff. I got this sense of like, I'm being disobedient, and I'm not trying to sling that at anyone else. But for me, I felt a strong sense of like, I know what the right thing to do is. I'm choosing the drink instead. And that really bothered me. The idea of like, I have my ideals. I have what's important to me. I know these things are important, even if like tonight, it's not like I'm giving all that up. If I continue on this path, I am choosing the alcohol over everything that is important to me. It's like I've heard it said that, you know, it eventually takes everything from you. And by the time it's done that, you don't even care anymore. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to get there. So what happened was, a couple of days ago with my journaling time, I just listed out all my reasons again. I said, okay, well, are those short-term or long-term reasons or both? Is this a self-centered reason? Is it a God-centered reason? Is it a family-centered reason? And so I sort of, you know, crossed off the list for everything that I categorized as self-centered. And I just looked at, you know, what do I need to do for family and for God? And specifically, what are the short-term ones that even tonight are reasons why I need to not drink? And just throughout the day, I looked at that, I prayed, and I went back on two passages of scripture that were especially meaningful to me and just really tried to reflect on that. And facing off that, I said, okay, I want to visualize what it is like to drive straight from work to home and not stop off at my usual places on the way. I want to visualize that sense of triumph and like, oh yeah, it's working now. God is helping me. I'm doing this in His strength because my strength is not sufficient, but yeah, it's working. And I visualized that. I visualized going into my driveway and then I performed that, which I had visualized. Actually got home that night and I'm like, yeah, this is great. The next morning I did some more journaling about that, thought about it, reviewed my reasons, reviewed my motivations, and I felt a lot more hopeful.
Was this just 2 days ago?
Yeah, this is 2 days ago.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah, the opposite of addiction is connection. And listeners, journaling is such a good way for you to connect with yourself. Absolutely, you are connecting with you, the universe. You're putting what's in the mind onto paper. You're taking the form of a thought and maybe putting it into the material world. absolutely an incredibly powerful tool. You visualizing, you practicing, you seeing it in your mind, driving home from work without stopping at a liquor store, all potentials exist in the quantum field. You are tapping into that. You felt it. You felt the reality of it. Boom, here we are today, day three. Jim, does it feel, actually, before I get to that question, talk to us about your faith. Are you praying to Jesus? Is he your dude right now, Jesus Ben Joseph?
Yeah. Yes, I'm just a run-of-the-mill Christian. Yeah.
For sure. And whatever works, you know, there's something about what that guy said to have the best-selling book of all time. Right. And whatever works, the higher power spirituality, I feel, is incredible on this journey. It's a must. And a lot of times, you know, I've covered the order of healing. First, it's physical, then mental, then spirituality. But usually there's a spiritual moment right around the time when we quit drinking. It sounds like you've been there. What were the scriptures that you're talking about?
Yeah, I'll try not to bore the listeners who may not find this especially useful. But the one, there's a guy, goes to Jesus, says, "Hey, I've done everything right. I've kept all the commandments. What else do I need to do to enter the kingdom of heaven?" And Jesus says to him, "You know, you're right. You've done pretty good. All you need to do," this guy's kind of rich, he's well-dressed, okay? Jesus says to him, "What you need to do then is just, you know, sell everything, give it to the poor, and come follow me." And he walks away sad, because I believe that Jesus understood his heart, knew, yeah, you followed the commands, that's cool, but there's something that you love more than God. And I always thought, well, okay, you know, I'm not that rich guy. Whoa, is there something I love more than God? Okay, I know my thing. I know that the lesson I need to take from this, me personally, and I'm not talking about anyone else, is, yeah, I need to go give up the alcohol and come follow. So that's the one. That's my particular thing. This is my thing. It's not going to stop being my thing. That obedience for me means that even though everyone else can be free to drink and that's fine, I can't. That's the lesson that I took for me. The other one, there's this there's an account that's given of a guy who's he's crippled. He's been crippled basically since birth, and Jesus comes doing his miracles and stuff, and Jesus walks over to him and says, "Hey, do you want to get better?" And what he says is a bunch of lame excuses. He's like, "Oh, look, what can I do? Every time I try to go to the healing pool, people are in front of me. I can't get there." And you read the text, and it's almost as if Jesus is saying, "Get up, take up your mat, and walk." And the guy does. And so, you know, and the thing that I take from this for me is God has the power to heal me, but I need to do my part. I need to get up and be willing to at least go along with it, to not say, yeah, but I want to drink tonight. I need to be willing to accept, yeah, sobriety is my next step. It might be painful. It's the right thing. I will choose that. And with that willingness, I believe that God is helping me along.
I like that last. I like them all three, Jim. Thank you for sharing. I like that last one too, where God or the universe is willing to help, but you also need to take one step towards him, it, her, however you want to describe it. Thank you, Jim. I know our listeners, not everybody, you know, follows the same faith, and we get that. We're cool with that. But I know everybody pulled something out of that. So, man, does something feel different this time around?
Yeah. I feel like I've done a lot of field research, and it's not just a matter of I know how bad drinking is. I also feel like I know how good sobriety is, and I know that I might fall down at some point. I'm willing to let God give me the strength to not. But if it does happen, I also know that I can bounce back. So through Cafe RE, I got set up with an accountability partner, and he gave me a really good piece of wisdom. He said to me, you know, it's okay if you fall down. It's okay if you get stuck. You just can't stay there. And I realized I might fall down, but I'm not going to stay there. And that's also something that I've been reflecting on the past few days. It's like, you know, I'm not going to just let myself succumb to it. And so what's new now is just a sense of, I'm going to be honest with my wife. I am going to I'm not going to give myself over to this.
Jim, on what your accountability partner said, I'm going to remix that a bit. To live is to fall down. To live is to be marked, to have challenges. To live is to fall down. I love it. I love it. Love it. Jim, what's your plan for day four, day five, day six to get that first week? What are we going to do?
Yeah. So I think, you know, it's going to be just avoiding those opportunities, not being alone. You know, just spending a lot of time with my family and having people around, having things to go to, being so occupied in, you know, taking care of my awesome aquarium or doing woodwork that, like, or just, you know, home improvement projects that, you know, I don't feel that need to like, I don't even feel the boredom of like, hey, can you think of an excuse to head to the home improvement store? You know, stuff like that.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Well, man, let us know if there's anything that we can help. I know the listeners and myself right now, we are sending good energies to you, Jim. You can do it. What is that line? Ask and you shall
receive.
Ah, that's it. That's it. I have found in my alcohol-free journey that is a universal law. There's a little bit of a lag time I have witnessed, but ask and you shall receive. And I have received everything that I've ever asked for. Wholeness, authenticity, challenges at the same time to help me grow. And my goodness, the growth we go through when we depart and emerge on the other side of an alcohol addiction is tremendous. And I think the biggest gift an addiction gives us is the connection to the self. Man, I've really enjoyed this interview, Jim. We have hit the rapid fire round. You can answer each of these questions for the next 10 or for 10 to 15 seconds. That would be great. Are you ready?
Totally.
Let's do it. Jim, what's the one thing you've learned about yourself on this journey?
I'm not as rational as I think I am.
Gotcha. What's your best sober moment?
The one that comes to mind right now is just when my wife told me that she was proud of how far I've come.
Hell yeah. So we are as well. What's your favorite alcohol-free drink?
Kombucha, ginger.
Ah, I had a mango kombucha last night. What's your favorite 90s band?
Hate to say it, Alice in Chains, just like everyone else, but you know.
Yeah, what advice do you have for your younger self?
Oh, gee, open your eyes, watch what's happening. If you're gonna drink, see if you're drinking more now than you were a year ago.
And last question, what parting piece of guidance can you give to listeners?
I'm just gonna have to echo my accountability partner on this. You know, if you get stuck, that's okay, but you just can't stay there.
And then before we depart, Jim, you might need to ditch the booze. Give us a line.
Okay. If you find yourself waking up in a panic at 1:40 a.m. and you realize, uh-oh, you need to hurry to the gas station before last call, you might need to ditch the booze.
Oh, yeah, that for sure checks out. I had a couple late scrambles, like at 1:56 a.m., you know, 4 minutes to get in my car to the gas station. Oh, man. And again, like I said, the newcomer, it's just so fresh. So thank you for reminding me what it's like, Jim. You've helped my journey. I feel less alone this last hour. I hope you do the same. I know you're going to help a lot of people. Keep in touch. Thank you for being part of Cafe RE. Thank you for listening. You know, you're a big part of this alcohol-free movement. Yeah, great job, Jim. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
I remember reading an article written by a normal drinker about those in recovery. He compared us to Homer in the Odyssey. As in, those in recovery are the ones who found a way to live life in this world without being pulled into the siren song. This is an incredible feat in a world which seems to be currently in a level 10 stupor or binge. We are not weak. Quite the contrary, in fact. We are the ones doing the heavy lifting for the generations to come. There's no other group of people that I want a podcast to. I love you all. Recovery Elevator, go big, because eventually we'll all go home.